You're listening to Backstage at Lyric, the podcast that takes you behind the curtain at Lyric Opera of Chicago. Backstage at Lyric features in-depth interviews with the singers, conductors, and creative minds behind the productions in the 2007-2008 season. For additional interactive content and to order tickets, visit us online at lyricopera.org.
Tenor Frank Lepardo is backstage at Lyric.
There's nothing better. It's become my favorite role. Of all the things that I sing, there's something very poignant about this role, and I'm enjoying singing it again immensely. I don't sing it enough.
Thank you for downloading this episode of Backstage at Lyric, the podcast that takes you behind the scenes of one of the world's great opera companies. I'm Roger Pines of Lyric Opera of Chicago. In this episode, I have the pleasure of speaking with the renowned American tenor Frank Lepardo, one of the Lyric Opera audience's favorite artists, who's returning for his first Russian role with the company, Lenski, in Tchaikovsky's Eugene Onegin, the ninth leading role he sung at Lyric. Before we play the interview, here's a brief synopsis of the opera. An impressionable country girl, Tatiana, falls in love at first sight with her new neighbor, the debonair and bored Onegin. She writes him a letter explaining her feelings, which he rejects politely but firmly. At a party, he flirts with Tatiana's sister Olga, whose fiancé is the poet Lenski, Onegin's good friend. Onegin is challenged by the jealous Lenski to a duel, in which Lenski is killed. After several years of traveling abroad, Onegin returns to St. Petersburg and sees Tatiana at a ball. She's now the wife of the much older Prince Grayman. Onegin realizes he loves Tatiana and writes her a passionate letter. When she receives him at her home, she admits that she still loves him. Rather than running away with him, however, she chooses to remain with her husband, leaving Onegin in despair. Now, on to the interview with Frank Lepardo. I hope you enjoy it. I'm here with Frank Lepardo, who is returning to Lyric to sing the role of Lenski in Eugene Onegin. And I wanted to talk first, Frank, about how you would sum up the appeal of this piece. I think it's one of the most appealing operas in the repertoire, and yet the world doesn't know it the same way they would know a Carmen or a Bohème.
The appeal, to me, seems like it could even go a little further. I think it can take its place in the forefront of the repertoire. I think it's just the most lavish score, truly a gift, particularly my aria at the end of the opera. I mean, at the end of the duel scene, there's nothing better. It's become my favorite role. Of all the things that I sing, there's something very poignant about this role, and I'm enjoying singing it again immensely. I don't sing it enough. But I think anyone who hears the score from I just was listening to an orchestral rehearsal before the singers came in, and it really does stand alone. There are aspects of it that you could do, you know, without the singers from time to time, because it's just, Tchaikovsky is fantastic.
Well, I mean, orchestrally it's so beautiful too. I mean,
that's what I mean.
Yeah.
It does stand, it does hold, it has a life. It's not just accompaniment, it has an orchestral life or an underbody all its own.
And we should remind people that this is, you know, if they know the Nutcracker, if they know, you know, Sleeping Beauty and that sort of thing, Swan Lake, the Tchaikovsky ballets, then they would relate immediately to everything that's going on musically.
Yes, I think that's very interesting you say that, because really the entire score is very quote-unquote danceable. It's like you can do a ballet suite based on Eugene Onegin if you wanted to.
And that's in fact, there
idea.
Is a...
Oh, okay, so yeah. You know how much I know about the body of Tchaikovsky's work.
He didn't write the ballet, but it was taken... there's a ballet based on Eugene Onegin that's mm-hmm. taken from various Tchaikovsky mm-hmm. sources. That's one of the great ballets in the repertoire. Mm-hmm. But you're known for Mozart and Bel Canto, Verdi, Puccini. I mean, this is the only Russian role you sing. But musically, it relates pretty well to your other repertoire, doesn't it?
Yes, it does. It does. I mean, in terms of reputation, I'm so far removed from the composers you just mentioned that I'm looking at there's a good span of 15 years between Mozart and Rossini and the Bel Canto composers and what I'm doing now. But it seems that those composers served me very well. And it's the first thing I think about when I'm preparing this music in particular, because it's a very lyric role. Although it's very low, the tessitura is very, very low. And then he requires you to do some fairly, you know, maybe F, F sharp, G, A singing, but nothing. There are no high C's in this that you need to be concerned with. But it is the basis for this in terms of legato and all of that is very, very firmly rooted in Mozart, I would say. More so than Rossini, you know.
And a lot of your great predecessors in the role, really, a lot of them have been Mozart singers when I think about it.
I'd like to think that the people that have been probably most successful with this were actually Russian singers. So to be given this responsibility, it's kind of a heavy load, being that I'm not Russian speaking. But from what I understand, my Russian colleagues tell me my diction's not bad, and, you know, I got the idea in terms of style. It's just that the Russian language can make one oversing this piece sometimes.
How so?
Oversing the consonants too much. It's as legato a language as Italian is, really. We spoke about this once before. And that if you go to the vowel and delay the following consonant as much as possible, just like you would in Italian, then you're right in line with the Russian style, really.
Now, when you began to move beyond the lighter Mozart and Rossini into what we would call the full lyric repertoire, was Lenski a particular goal for you?
No. In fact, because of the Russian, I had tended to, you know, when I was a young singer and I would go to auditions, I'd hear many of my contemporaries sing Lenski's aria in the audition. I thought, yeah, I'm going to stay away from that. I don't think that's for me, you know. And then there was an opportunity to sing in Paris to make my Paris opera debut, and this was the opera. And it came a good 3 or 4 years prior to the actual engagement, so I had plenty of time to prepare it. But no, this was not an aspiration of mine. And after doing this, I was offered Pique Dame, which doesn't really fall in line, because even within Tchaikovsky, you have your lyric tenor roles, and then it's quite dramatic, Pique Dame. And I was offered Iolante also, which is a very interesting story. But, you know, once people hear you sing something well, they tend to want to lead you in this direction to become a quote-unquote specialist in this repertoire, and that's not what I wanted, you know.
Now, you've got the most famous of all Russian tenor arias to sing, which you mentioned before in Act Two. And before that, your first scene, you have this wonderful love song that you sing to your beloved, Olga. So can you tell our audience what's going on in those arias and what the basic musical feeling is?
Well, in the first aria, or the first arioso, we could really call it that, because it can't really be extracted and sung on its own. It's something that really has to take place within the framework of the piece. The aria proper at the end of the opera can really be, you could do that in a concert quite easily. But the first one is not constructed that way. But they do represent two different times in Lenski's life. And the first one being that he's full of joy, poetic. He's always poetic, even in the second aria, but he's full of hope and he's more idealistic. And in a very short period of time, he changes to what he eventually becomes, you know, looking at life in a totally different way, and possibly the very end of his life. He comes to the stage with the idea that he will not survive this. It's not a positive intention that he has here that he will win this duel. He knows that he probably shouldn't have made this challenge. It wasn't really his best moment. But he's going to go through with it, because at least if Olga couldn't fall in love with his poetic side, perhaps the thing that would appeal to her most is this chivalry which he tries to display at the end. Even if he's not here to see her reaction, he even says it in the aria. He says, remember me when I pass as someone who gave his whole heart and soul for you. You see, so my subtext is such that I think that he believes that if he does just one thing well, he can still leave a lasting impression on her. You know, he denounces her in public, but I don't think he doesn't stop loving her. But he knows that his poetic gestures and his other ways of going about wooing Olga didn't work. And I think in some strange way, he challenges Onegin to impress her in a way, or to display that side of the of a type of manhood, or so to speak, that she might appreciate.
Well, it's funny because when he sings the arioso you were talking about before in the first scene, it's like he's singing what every young woman, I should think, would dream of having her, the man she loves, sing to her, and yet it doesn't really work.
Well, yeah, that's very interesting you should say that, but it, in essence, she reacts like many young girls would, I think, even today. They like the aloof guys. They tend to go, my experience as a young man was, you know, every time I displayed or showed my affection for a girl too soon, she tended to, you know,
pull
bolt.
Back. Yeah.
Yeah, she tended to pull back. And, you know, when I learned the ropes and just kind of, you know, was aloof and cool, I actually, you know, did better, so to speak. But, you know, he's not like that. He doesn't understand that. He thinks he's made certain choices in his life. And he believes, like I did as a young person, that because he's chosen something artistic, then he's making an effort to understand the world in a different way, that the world will understand him better. And in fact, it's just the opposite. And that's why I think I have some parallels with this man, because I always believed, before I even became a professional singer, that people who sing must be really good people. It was one of those things I believed in my teens that, oh my God, you know, turning on a record and hearing Luciano, or even further back, Gigli Di Stefano, Björling, Tagliavini, what have you. Boy, these must be really good people, because look how beautiful they sound. Listen to that. There must be some element of this human being that is angelic in a way. Or, you know what I mean? I know it, obviously, it's very, you know, anyone listening to this is going to say, boy, he didn't get it, did he? But this is Lenski. This is Lenski. He believes that his poetic gestures, his writings, he presents her with poems. You know, girls like Jules, well, he brings a portfolio of his writing. It's he believes that the world will love him more, will love this poetic side of him.
It's so sweet in the staging. I was watching the other day, and I saw in the course of the aria, you give her the poetry, and she lets some of the sheets sort of fall onto the ground.
Yes, they fall down like the leaves that are in the scene. The leaves are covering the stage.
And so he very carefully picks it up
and gives it back to her. And he's not put out by her... you know, her careless dropping of the poems. He picks them up, gives them back to her, and continues and keeps trying. And it's not until he sees Olga being seduced to some degree that this is a complete shock to him and a real wake-up call to how, you know, who she really is, or who Onegin really is, and the culmination of the two just really sends him over the deep end, I think.
Now, he is barely out of his teens.
But
there's no teenager anywhere who could sing this role.
Well, that goes for the good majority of the age of most characters in opera. I think Lucia is 15. I think, you know, Edgardo, but of course, right.
But what I love...
That's the believability that we need the audience to come with us on and just say, look, let's just for a moment try to believe that Frank Lepardo's 18.
But what I loved about the rehearsal watching you is that your whole body language was totally that of a 20-year-old, and...
Well, I mean, I remember what it was like. I don't move that way most of the time, you know. I just turned 50. You know, things happen. Your body changes. But I do know what physically, as a singing actor, what is required of this young hopeful, you know. And so, Hope, thank you for saying that, because I was hoping that it came across youthful.
Oh, it's very endearing. Yeah. It's wonderful.
Yeah.
Now, and I don't speak Russian, but I'm sitting there listening to you and recognizing that the sounds and the inflections are right, and in rehearsal you just sound, it seemed like you were totally in command to my ear of the language. So did you get a lot of help with it years ago? I mean, didn't you worked with...
Oh, I'd say in combination with listening to a number of recordings just to, you know, get that sound in my ear. I think I was kind of given this ear, the hearing, the music of language and grasping that. And then just studying the phonetics, breaking down the Cyrillic, learning the Cyrillic values, phonetic values. And then I'm afraid I had to abandon just looking at the Cyrillic and depending on that alone for the diction. So what I did was write in IPA, which is International Phonetic Alphabet, on over my line, melodic line, and that worked. And plus, I have to say, I'm very blessed that I worked with Sergei Leifekus, who taught it to me many years ago, taught me the diction. Then Dmitry Hostovsky also worked with me. I worked with a number of coaches. And, you know, if it's good, it's only because of the hard work. It's not because I'm not Russian speaking, and I must tell you that I spend a lot of sleepless nights hoping that it's authentic, because at least that, you know, especially when you're in a cast. The first time I did it, I was in a cast, I was the only English speaking person. I mean, not only was I non-Russian, but no one else spoke any English. I had a hard time, you know, communicating with anyone else. Miss Gorchakova was the Tatiana, and so there it was a great vote of confidence even at that time that they said, you can go to Russia and sing this, it's really good. And that's important to me.
One wonderful thing about your being here in this is not just that it's your first Russian role with the company, but it's a reunion for you with Dina Kuznetsova, with whom you did our Rigoletto, mm-hmm. and with whom you've done Rigoletto twice in Cincinnati.
Yes. So this is my third outing with her, yes.
Which I think is marvelous to have for someone doing a role for the first time, to have the kind of support that you're able to present.
Well, you know, I've been on all the so-called levels of this art form and as a singer, and I know what it's like to be new to something and old to something now. I've been around for almost 30 years, so I have enough of a memory to recall when singers who are much older than me were not as gracious, I have to say. I don't mean to be talking out of school, but in fact, that older generation of singers sometimes was not as welcoming to the new generation. But I'm not like that, and I embrace everyone who is on the stage with me as my colleague, regardless of how many years they have in it. It doesn't make any sense to me to analyze an individual's involvement in this art form and say, okay, now you're past the point where it's comfortable for me to consider you my colleague. You're my colleague from the moment we start rehearsals, regardless of your time in this, you know. And Dina, I mean, I actually in many ways look up to Dina. She's such a professional, so very well prepared. And if she's new to this business, you could have fooled me, because she's just so inspirational and so easy to work with that compared to many veterans, I would much prefer to share the stage with her.
You've been incredibly careful, I think, about when in the course of the career you decide to take a particular role on, mm-hmm. and Lenski was one of those that you waited on, just as you waited for Verdi and Puccini, until a particular moment when you said, okay, this is, you know, the time has come. And I don't think people necessarily appreciate how important those decisions really are, because they can, you know, profoundly affect a career. So how do you determine when the time is right?
You know,
my
teacher, Dr. Robert White Jr., who's a teacher now at the Juilliard School, after many years of teaching in many places, he's landed at Juilliard, and I think that's going to be his last assignment in terms of a institution. But he's been teaching singers for many, many years. It taught me this conservative approach. He taught me very early on that if you don't have your voice and it's not intact and it's not healthy, then you have nothing, you have no chips to put on the table. See, when you're in Vegas and you're playing baccarat, you're playing blackjack, once your chips are gone, you need to walk away. It's time to walk away from the table. Well, I don't know if that parallel, the parallel is that if you can't sing, if your voice is damaged, it's time to go away. It's not, you have nothing more to offer. And so that's something that has always guided me and I've always been afraid of. And I've, in all honesty, I don't know how many singers would be that honest with you, I've always been a good steward of my instrument, because I knew that if I couldn't sing, I'd have no place in this art form, in this tradition anymore. And that's the thing. However, having said that, it's also something that has backfired on me in many ways. Because of my conservative approach, I've often had to say no to things that have been offered to me along the way by people who did not understand what it is I was trying to do in terms of longevity. So it was not my intention to create enemies, but and not saying that they are, but I did I did create some, I burned a few bridges there because I had to say no. After much looking at roles or even, and there were roles in the course of my life that I had been contracted to do, and realized at the 11th hour that this might not be the best idea, and I didn't present it. And then there were some roles which I probably should have canceled, you know, but by virtue of desire and some things that I've wanted all my life to sing, I didn't walk away from them. But this very philosophy has done me some detriment, you know, I think.
On the other hand, your predecessor, Alfredo Kraus, had a pretty conservative approach, and he was still singing when he was 70.
This is true. I mean, but I don't know if we can certainly try to individually use Kraus as an example for good vocal health, good repertoire choices, and sticking to our guns in terms of those choices. But I don't think another Kraus will be very readily welcomed. He was truly a specialist in his field and his craft. And specialists are not, there are no specialists anymore. If that were the case, I would have stayed with Mozart almost exclusively and not gone on to any other composer if I felt that I could have made a living and sustained life. I have a wife and two sons. And if I could have, you know, kept that all going, singing only the top, you know, Mozart roles, I never would have moved on. But that kind of specialization doesn't exist anymore.
We should say a bit about your wonderful association with this company. I mean, this is your 9th role with us, and you're coming back next year to do your 10th, which will be Pinkerton and Madame Butterfly. Mm-hmm. How would you describe the time that you've had here? I mean, your relationship with the company in general.
Well, even though I'm a New Yorker, and even though I was a supernumerary at the Metropolitan Opera and sang at the Metropolitan Opera every season for 17 years, I should say, I consider Chicago my home company. I consider this my American company, my home company, because I have not been embraced to the extent by anywhere else in the world like I have been embraced here. And when I come through the doors of this theater, I have a far different feeling of just being able to take a breath and feel like I'm home. And I'm not from Chicago. I have a great love and affection for Chicago, but I'm not from here. And one would think that I would embrace the Metropolitan Opera in New York in that way. But in fact, I don't. And I'm not embarrassed by that. And I'm very, very proud and very glad to say that my affiliation and the faith that artist Krainic had in me back in the early 80s created this long-term relationship, you know, and which Mr. Mason, Bill Mason, has continued, and I'm just overjoyed. I can honestly say that in terms of my American involvement, this is the only company that embraces me in this way.
Thank you very much, and I wish you all the best for Onegin.
Well, thank you. I'm looking forward to it.
You've been listening to Backstage at Lyric, the podcast that takes you behind the scenes at Lyric Opera of Chicago. Backstage at Lyric features interviews with the creative forces behind the productions in the 2007-2008 season. For additional interactive content and to order tickets, visit us online at lyricopera.org.